This is episode 26 of the Software Freedom Law Show for Tuesday, April 27, 2010. Ahoy, hoy. This is the Software Freedom Law Show. I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn. I told you you didn't have to say ahoy hoy.
But you love ahoy hoy.
Well, it's...
Which to me sounds like a reference to The Simpsons, but...
Well, most people know it from there, which it's actually a very strange thing that The Simpsons used in that way, because it shows they did a little bit of research, but not a lot of research.
Okay. I don't watch much TV,
Have I ever talked about this on the Oddcast? I don't know if I ever talked... So Thomas Edison was an evil patent... type. He's probably more...
Well, he was a patent examiner, right? I forget.
I think he actually worked
in the patent office.
He may have. But he became obsessed with... many people attribute... So most people don't get patents for themselves individually. Their company gets a patent and they're listed as the inventor and then the company owns the patent.
I know people who have gotten patents, or know of people. I don't know them
it
well.
It exists, but it's not as common. And it was really Edison who... So I read that Edison...
And a lot of, like, you know, hopeful companies that are not companies yet.
Mm-hmm. True. But Edison is attributed with being the first person to really encourage his employees to get patents, and then they were consigned to the company rather than to the individual. And so Edison's companies were some of the largest early patent holders in the 1800s. And so he's a very evil patenter guy. And he actually, there's actually this thing, which I guess I'm going to have to find for the show notes now, but it should be easy to find because we talked about it on Identica, that he had some of the earliest EULAs for recording.
Is that true?
Yeah. I think our colleague Aaron did some research. It wasn't the earliest EULA, but it was one of the earliest.
Wow.
His early phonographic recordings that you bought had a EULA on it and didn't allow you to transfer it to another party.
It's not the legacy that we ordinarily hear about.
Well, people take these business people as if they're great and awesome. So anyway, so he was working on the telephone in parallel to Bell. And Edison did a lot of the rollout of initial telephone service. And Edison was like Steve Jobs. He was one of these very much micromanaging company types who had to control everything. And he decided what the operators, the scripts they should follow when they say. And he thought the right thing to say when you answer the phone was hello, which is based on a German word from a long time ago. And he felt that that was connected up correctly with what you should say on the phone. And Bell thought you should say ahoy hoy. It was a term used in ships, ships when they were communicating.
Okay.
They used it in like.
It sounds like a nautical.
It was a nautical
expression.
Phrase. Yes. So he felt that that was the right thing to say when you answered the phone.
And actually, the construction that we have in the background here, I don't know if you guys can hear it, but it kind of sounds like a foghorn. So it's like this weird ahoy hoy, and then there's like mwah.
The people say they can't hear it though.
Oh, okay. Well, you heard my impression of it.
It sounds like Foghorn Leghorn. That's strange.
Foghorn Leghorn.
He's that giant chicken from the Warner Brothers cartoons.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
The big giant chicken.
Oh.
I'll say.
Yes, that's his name.
His name is Foghorn Leghorn.
Foghorn Leghorn.
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 Leghorn. Yeah. Leghorn.
Yeah. Fascinating.
You didn't know that was Foghorn Leghorn?
No.
Really say his name on the cartoons. I was much older when I learned that that was his name.
You could hear Bradley typing because he's just found pictures of...
I wanted to get a little picture of Foghorn Leghorn for Karen there. That's Foghorn Leghorn.
Looking awfully smug.
That was sort of his thing. I say I'm smug, I say.
Yeah.
He has a Wikipedia entry. It's so weird that they make Wikipedia entries for... Such
his first
extensive.
Appearance was in Walkie Talkie Hockey.
Yeah, it's weird to have Wikipedia entries for fictional characters that are so intricate.
Why?
I suppose it's appropriate.
I think it's appropriate. I don't see why it's weird at all, actually. Yeah.
It just seems weird. He's an anthropomorphized adult rooster. So so anyway, the reason that... So Edison is this evil licensing dude, patent licensing, copyright licensing, and so forth. But he had this argument with Bell where he didn't want... people say hoi hoi. I thought hello was the right thing. And there, I saw this documentary. I've actually looked various times for better documentation for us. I think I'm going to have to go to a library and look on paper because there's not really good documentation online. But I did see a documentary on PBS, which is public television in the United States. Most television is not publicly funded in the U.S., unlike other places. So there's one thing that's publicly funded television called Public Broadcasting System, PBS, for international listeners. So anyway, I was watching this PBS documentary about the early telephone, and apparently they wanted, when Edison ran the first transcontinental phone line, they wanted to have him in one city, and like one of them was San Francisco, one of them was New York, and they were going to make the first transcontinental phone call.
Right.
And they wanted it to be Bell on one end and Edison on the other.
Ah. As a PR and they couldn't agree what to say?
Well, Bell refused to do it unless Edison would say ahoy hoy. So apparently Edison said, that's the one time Edison said ahoy hoy, because Bell would not do it. And so they said ahoy hoy. He said ahoy hoy, Mr. Edison. Ahoy hoy, Mr. Bell.
Wow, it's just like other people we know who are sticklers for...
terminology?
For terminology, yeah.
Yeah, so he wouldn't do... So I guess you're saying RMS wouldn't do a transatlantic free software SIP phone
Where you'd have to use the term open source? No, he probably would not.
Probably would not. And you'd say GNU/Linux.
Exactly.
Say, hello from my GNU/Linux server, he couldn't say. He would say ahoy ahoy. I've actually tried to convince Stallman. I haven't gotten to bring it up with RMS yet, but I think he would agree with me about ahoy ahoy.
Well, and what's the origin of the shortening to hi? Is that directly from hello?
I think I looked into that once, and it was related to hello, and that's why
sufficiently enough that you were not that it supported this Edison. Yeah. It's a little strange.
I don't know. I don't say I'm not perfectly consistent, but I've tried to say ahoy ahoy rather than hello.
Uh huh. I've noticed, which is why I jokingly said ahoy hoy when we started the episode.
So
a little window into
Edison,
our lives.
Edison is evil. That's the story.
Well, he's not anything now.
Well, his legacy has brought evil onto our world.
I mean, I guess he is something now.
You know, I got a hard time about using the word evil recently.
Yes, I believe that I gave you a hard time about using the word evil.
You weren't the only one. So I did this panel at the Linux Collaboration Summit. It was about network services, and I said during the panel that proprietary software and proprietary network services are evil.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a few people came out to me afterwards and felt that I had been unfair. I don't know what unfair is not the right word, but they felt that
did they think it was offensive?
Maybe a little.
Okay.
They didn't come up to me and say were offended, but they were bothered. Clearly, they were. It upset them.
And what
them.
Did they say?
Well, they. One of the main points, because Canonical was on the panel as well, and I was talking about the fact that Ubuntu One is a network service and it's proprietary software. And my argument was that it's an evil thing. And I think that I used the word insidious as well, because I felt like...
It's a great word to use on a panel. Whenever appropriate, I use the word insidious.
Well, and I particularly felt that...
Well, because insidious is not as far as evil.
Actually, they seem more bothered by insidious than evil, as it turns out. But all that
surprises me.
All that set of terminology, they had a problem with. And I think where I was very willing to talk to everybody afterwards, and I think I got the understanding of why they were objecting, which I sort of understood. I think people, and it was all hackers I was talking to, pretty much all hackers I was talking to, and their argument was that evil, and to some extent insidious as well, is like a bit value, that there isn't gradations of evil, that there aren't some things that are more evil than others. And as a conscient ethicist, I don't think that way. I think that there are gradations. No, I really, I've talked about this online a bit lately. I, when I read Immanuel Kant in college, I was completely convinced that this was the ethical system for me, and that this was the right ethical system, and it made so much more sense than traditional utilitarian ethics or the crazy Ayn Rand crap that some people believe. Conscient ethics, at least the utilitarianism I can understand, but it wasn't for me. I just didn't see greatest good for the greatest number as a way to think. Mm-hmm. I think in moral imperatives and hierarchies of moral imperatives, that some moral imperatives are more important than others. So when I say something's evil, I'm not saying that it's Hitler, right? To invoke God.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's definitely a more nuanced position than say the situation. I'm more sympathetic to people who complain about referring to someone as a Nazi.
Well, that's like, that's
soup Nazi.
That's
or,
true.
You know,
true Goblin's Law stuff. That's
so
taking it.
Well,
too far.
Well, exactly right. And I guess, but they were making the same complaint about evil. And I don't like using the term evil actually, because I think not only is it an oversimplification, but it paints this picture of you know, it calls to mind, you know, the fairy tales of our youth and the evil stepmother. It's like it puts it in this fantastical realm. And you wind up not really talking about what the issue actually is. It's kind of an escape from talking about what it is by painting it as being so horrible that it's evil.
Yeah, and because of the people's reaction to it, which I never really truly noticed before, I guess I should have sooner, I wasn't being perceptive enough. I'm actually going to try to think more carefully about using that kind of terminology, because I think they were correct that it was turning the audience off from the message I was trying to express. And anytime you're turning the audience off from your message, then it's not good for you no matter what, and it's not good for the cause.
It's, I mean, it's not, yeah, if you don't have a way of engaging a dialogue, then you're lost.
But one of the points I made to somebody who came up afterwards, I said, well, there's lots of things I think are evil that are not that bad. Like, not failing to recycle, I think, is evil. So I sort of saw, the analogy
yeah,
I made was...
That's really tough, though, because it's more nuanced than that.
I don't know about that. So my analogy I made is selling proprietary software is sort of akin to having an aluminum can and walking up to a trash can and a recycling bin and somebody coming up and saying, I'll give you $10 if you put the aluminum can in the regular trash can so that it doesn't get recycled,
or
as
worse,
opposed to putting it in the recycling
like
bin.
Throwing your trash out in the mailbox.
People do that?
Well,
that is pretty evil. That is evil. I'll say it.
Someone who's very close to me had a banana peel in his hand, and he said, "Do you see a trash can?" And I said, "No." And he said, "How about a mailbox?" And he was joking, and I said, I was horrified. I said, "You wouldn't do that." And he said, "Well, I don't know if it occurred to me. I wouldn't do it, but if it occurred to me, it surely has occurred to somebody else." So clearly, people. And he's like, clearly, people throw trash into the mailbox.
That's a different level of evil.
Okay, but now
so
my question is:
evil
is something that's wrong by definition evil?
See, I think wrong and evil are somewhat interchangeable.
See, but to me, that's not because evil is so It's like such a. It's such a colorful expression, and it's so fantastic that, you know, I don't know, maybe my upbringing is coming out here, but evil does sound like a caricature and an extreme thing. And that's not to say that there aren't things that are evil in this world, but I do reserve the term evil for really extreme things. I think a lot of people do, and consequently, you know, I know people who get immediately turned off from talking about free software, for example, when the term evil comes into it, then they're like, oh my goodness, I don't want to talk about evil. You think things are evil. You're not living in, you know, you're not living in the real world. You're in a fairy tale world because we talk about evil, you know, evil witches and evil stepmothers and evil this and evil that in fairy tales, not in real life.
So if I say something's morally wrong, is that, that's sort of, I think the word evil is a shorthand for morally wrong.
See, but I don't think it is. And I think morally wrong is a more subtle way of referring to, I mean, not that it's subtle. I mean, that's pretty clear, but, you're looking up evil.
I'm looking up evil on a free dictionary, which means it's old. I don't know. Having qualities tending to injury and mischief, having a natural or,
do we need to get the Black's Law dictionary again?
With tends to
badness. I don't think evil is in there.
Not good.
I really want to find out, maybe in the next segment.
Worthless or deleterious.
But
poor.
But what a technical definition of a word is different than,
I know,
than the rhetorical power of a word.
Actually, the second definition is what I'm using. Having or exhibiting bad moral qualities. Morally corrupt. Wrong.
See, but then when you get to, like, vicious, like, you know, it's...
Well, I think some proprietary software marketing is vicious. I don't think all proprietary software is vicious, I would say.
But look at all the examples, right? Yeah. I mean, a good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit. What a sign it is of evil life when death's approach is seen so terrible. Like, this is really reserved. I mean, the term evil is really, as I said, it is a bit fantastical. Is that a word? Fantastical.
I guess so.
The devil, Satan.
Well, no, that's for the evil one. I don't call people. I didn't call some leader of a semi-proprietary company evil one.
But that's part of the same problem.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't very many people in the software world I would call the evil one. Maybe Steve Jobs, but he is probably the most evil of all proprietary software executives. So
I don't want to have to judge. I don't want to have to judge. But,
yeah, I don't really judge people either. I judge actions. So almost evil. All of Steve Jobs' actions are evil in the world of software.
See,
so.
Right? That's the thing. Can actions? I guess actions can be evil.
Right. Yeah.
But not really, right? Like evil, which our own misdeeds have wrought. So the deeds create the evil. But are the deeds themselves evil? It's the person or the actor that is evil. So it is a statement. This is totally off topic.
No, it's not. It's why well, it's you know I pick it's obvious where I picked this terminology up from, and this is the kind of terminology that RMS uses.
Yeah.
And I agreed with it because I agreed that there was a moral incorrectness, there was moral wrong in proprietary software, and I believe that it's an ethical question. The funny thing is I've stopped saying ethical. Because that
See,
means
I don't
something
disagree
weird
that it's
to
an
lawyers.
Ethical. That it's an ethical question. I agree with that. The reason why the term ethical becomes tricky in a law firm is because we have. I'm telling our listeners is that we have. We have ethical rules that are called the ethics rules for lawyers, and each state in the United States adopts its own different rules, and they're rules like rules about advocating for your clients and keeping their information confidential and all those things that we talk about time and time again that constrain lawyers. But because those are called the ethics rules and we have all these discussions about, being ethically correct and worrying about our ethics, that when we talk about a question of ethics in the context of providing legal advice, it's confusing if you talk about issues of morality as terms of ethics, because most lawyers want to make sure that they satisfy the letter of their ethical rules, which are not always that easy to understand what they are. They're not always intuitive, and honestly, they don't necessarily always lead to the right result either. But we need to be within those actual rules as they're promulgated by, the state bar associations and things like that.
Which is funny because I used to use the phrase morally wrong, which I realized was bothering people. So I switched to saying ethically wrong, which seemed to not bother people as much.
Except it bothers all the lawyers
Except
you hang out with
all
the time. Wow. I mean, it doesn't bother us. It's just it gets confusing if you bring it up in a situation where we're worried that we will be delivering
the correct and the moment I stopped doing that was when I said at some point in a meeting that I thought something was ethically wrong, and two or three lawyers jumped down my throat that it wasn't against the
well because
the
we were so worried about them
rules, which it was I was not saying that I was saying it was proprietary software, therefore it was ethically
it
wrong.
It sounds like you can inadvertently attack a lawyer by referring to.
Yeah.
Because, we could be disbarred. A lot of discussions about what's morally or ethically right, people have very different viewpoints. And
so you're saying lawyers have no morals?
No, that's not what
They're
I'm saying.
They're amoral?
Certainly not.
I wasn't saying immoral. I was saying amoral.
Amoral.
Actually, I was talking to somebody at the same conference who was saying that the companies should all be amoral. Which I actually, that's actually one of the reasons I'm so against for-profit companies, because I agree with him. Most companies are amoral.
They're driven by their shareholders, so they're effectively driven by the morality of their shareholders, which is why some companies. Which is why some companies have adopted less financially advantageous policies because the shareholders have demanded them.
Well, I think companies are amoral because they're serving this.
Well, they're serving the shareholders, and where the shareholders have.
They're serving the shareholders' profits. They don't say I have to serve the shareholders' beliefs.
Yes, they do, because the shareholders can override their decisions. They can institute whoever they want in the board. Like they're often, almost always, driven by shareholder profit. But many times, shareholders insist that the profit is diminished for certain policies. That's why many companies have green policies. That does not drive shareholder profit directly. Sometimes it does, but often it doesn't. And it's just, it's usually has to come from the shareholders, or at least the shareholders have to acquiesce. So often the morality of a company is reflected by its shareholders' morality.
But the problem is
in their investment.
the reason I disagree with that is because I think it reflects an older view of how companies are structured, because most shareholders are institutional shareholders rather than individual shareholders now. So you have these layers of institutions in between. So when you have a mutual fund holding a company, and when most shareholders of a company are a bunch of mutual funds.
But then it's look through, right? Like, and we have, our retirement plans, for example, but for some for-profit companies offer this as well. So our retirement plans are all invested in a company. I mean, I guess we should say it's Social K, which basically focuses or limits investments to socially responsible companies. And there are arguments about what is socially responsible responsible. But
do you know how many of our mutual funds hold Microsoft, for example?
No,
I mean, I'm technically a Microsoft shareholder because my retirement plan's invested in Microsoft, and I've just had to live with that. Which sucks because they don't put free software as something on their morality list. Mm-hmm. It's better than we used to have because our formal plan, the primary
was that fund, like oil.
No, it was.
Halliburton. I thought we had like a serious Exxon Holdings.
There was that too, but number one was Halliburton. That was the main fund in our retirement plan was holding Halliburton, which is why I lobbied so much for having
and
it
switched. And I'm really glad you did. It's, you know.
But it's still not a perfect solution.
We're not holding Halliburton, which is much better.
No, but now we're holding Microsoft. So
it's still not a perfect solution, but it's a step in the right direction. And I think as more and more people adopt this kind of approach, then we sort of see that same, and it's basically look through. And you have this, like, you know, in effect, a domino effect of shareholders.
Yeah, and I wrote a letter when we signed up telling them that I had issues, and then it was ignored. I mean, it's going to be ignored because they're just taking the really big issues like no tobacco and no war machine companies and no oil companies and those
green
sorts
issue,
of things.
Environmental issues.
The really big issues that almost everybody agrees about, except for the truly evil people. There I go with that word again. If you think Halliburton's a good company, you have to be evil, right? I mean, and this is my I know that word is charged, but I think as a society,
it's more than charged.
We don't have a debate anymore in our society.
It's more than charged. It makes people think that you are oversimplifying, you're exaggerating, and you're not really talking about the details of the issue at hand. I'm saying this because I've had to have that conversation so many times. Like, you're a free software lawyer. That must mean that you think that, you know, you think that anyone, you know, you think that so-and-so, or you think that this is evil, and, you know, and I can't talk to anyone who is going to, you know, characterize, you know, me as evil or whatever. I'm a proprietary software developer, you know, you think I'm evil. And I say, I wish you would work on something else. You know, like,
I think the action is evil, not the person.
Most people, I don't think, would separate that. I think that's what we were talking about before when I was asking if deeds could be evil. It's that we associate the actor as being evil.
So, I think if you end your life and you've done more evil things than good things, you probably were an evil person, right?
Wow.
Do you know Ben Franklin used to do this at the end of every day? He used to tally up how many good things and how many bad things he'd done, or how many horrible, morally wrong and morally right things he'd done in a day, and try to keep his equation. It's a very utilitarian view. It's not a conscience view. He would add up and try to give basically weights to,
like, give himself a score for the
day. Yeah, exactly. And his actions and how moral his actions were.
I wonder what his test was for what was moral and what wasn't. He was an interesting character.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously did things that most people would consider immoral. And he was a pretty shrewd business person in the sense that I think there was a number of times he was not, and what I would think moral in the way that he interacted with other companies and so forth and competitors. So and various other things as well.
I mean, it's just that I think that so many people are in these hybrid situations, right? I know quite a number of developers that are employed as proprietary software developers, but write free software when they can, you know, that, you know, in their free time, they push for releasing what can be released, and they're in this hybrid situation. Are they evil? I mean,
I never said that they were evil. I never said people were evil.
I know, but it reads that way, and that's how people interpret it, and I think that's a real problem.
I've pointed out that I'm going to try to find better phrases to use. The thing is, I think if I say something is morally wrong, people are going to have the same reaction.
Well, no, I feel like if you say more, maybe this is just my view, but in my mind, I think if somebody says morally wrong, I want to learn more about it. Like, why do you think that, if I don't agree, which you and I are largely, you know, are often in agreement on free software issues, or largely in agreement, I would say. We occasionally disagree. which we try to bring to the podcast because I think it's interesting. Or outcast.
Well, I don't think that's a moral issue, calling it a podcast or an outcast.
No, I agree.
And then that's the other thing is I try to explain to people, I have lots of opinions about things. Like I have the opinion that we should probably try to say oddcast rather than podcast, but I don't think it's morally wrong to say podcast.
Right. Right. And I think what
I don't think it's evil to say podcast.
What I think I was saying, trying to say before, and then I actually interrupted myself was that, you know, when you characterize something as morally wrong, it makes me want to find, if I don't understand it, I want to find out more about it and understand what makes you come to that conclusion. Whereas if you say that something's evil, it feels like you've made a final proclamation and, you know, there's no sense in talking to you about it.
But this is where, I don't know if you want to get into this topic, but in related to a blog post I made recently talking about proprietary licenses, I was trying to say that there are gradations of how evil proprietary licenses can be.
See, and to me, because I don't like the term, because I feel that way about the term, it's somewhat meaningless to say degree that something is more or less evil. Like, I think some things are better than others, some things are worse than others, but it's like, it's really tough to, for me to grok the idea of something being more or less
evil. Well,
you were
saying that once something's proprietary, it's just proprietary, and then...
Well, proprietary software is proprietary software, but some terms of proprietary licenses are better than others, right? Like,
yeah, that was
that's what
point.
You were saying in your blog post, right? Like, you know, proprietary software agreement that lets you have source code is.
Yeah, so if you take a look at, for example, of all people, Microsoft did a release of something early on when they were trying to make themselves, you know, friendly to open source or whatever they were saying. They released I think it was actually some of the CLI, CLR stuff, CIL, CLR stuff that Mono now replaces, under a proprietary license. It was non-commercial use only, source code viewable mm-hmm. only. So you got the source code, you could study it. And of course, there were patents involved, so that was the true problem there. But notwithstanding the patent issues, being able to view the source code, even if you're not permitted to modify, well, first of all, you can probably modify it privately and no one's ever going to know anyway. But even if you can't distribute those modified versions.
Auditability of software is something that's very valuable.
Right. And when we connect it up to like your medical
devices. That's where I was going with that, is that, like, you know, even if the proprietary license were to be maintained for heart, you know, for my heart device, I'd feel a lot better if the source code were available and auditable.
Right.
So.
And that's like voting machines as well.
Yeah.
Where it wouldn't matter so much if you can't modify the voting machine software as long as you can review it. That's where the key freedom you need for that particular device
is. I don't think that my heart device is evil, because I probably wouldn't willingly put a piece of something evil in my body. But
is it going to upset you if I say that?
It does anger me that the software is withheld from me and from others from looking at it. But I don't think that it's evil. In fact, you know, I'd say that several times a day, I think about the fact that I have proprietary software in my body and it's upsetting to me. And at the same time, several times a day, I also think that I'm really glad I don't have to worry about suddenly dying. So, like, these two things are in my head often. So I wouldn't describe my
if you died suddenly, it would be evil.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way.
And it would be more evil than the proprietary software. See, this is where I get into the conscience ethics,
more and less evil.
It's more evil for you to not have, for example, not have the medical care that allowed you to have that device.
Right.
That would be a greater evil than the thing being proprietary software.
Can you all, not all of you, if you have a strong feeling about this, can you email us and let us know? Because I think if you're listening to us, you probably agree with us about a lot of things because, you know, in order to subscribe and listen to us again and again or even once. So email us at oddcast@softwarefreedom.org if you have a strong view about whether it's appropriate or not.
Which specific thing you're asking.
To use the term evil in this context.
Well, and I also want to know what people think about the other terms, like the morally wrong and ethically wrong. I pretty much banned myself from saying ethically wrong because it freaks out lawyers. So I had sort of fallen back to either saying morally wrong or evil.
That's just a really specific context. It's like when something has a...
Well, it's just...
Has an industry-related meaning.
Yeah, and well, the problem is that I try to limit the amount of confusion from the terminology I'm using. Mm-hmm. I mean, the main reason I'm concerned about this is not because I think they're the wrong words to use, but I see them creating confusion.
Right. I don't think that evil creates confusion. I just think that when you use the term evil, you marginalize yourself.
Well, but that's confusion because the only way I can
there's it's confusion about what your views actually are.
Yes, exactly. Because while many people think that seeing proprietary versus free as a moral issue, as a moral right and wrong, is marginalized. And if they believe that, then that's fine. I'm marginalized. Mm-hmm. But if they actually don't think that morality issue is marginalized, for example, John O'Bacon, who was on this panel with me, I think he actually believes that the view of right and wrong with regard to proprietary software is a marginal view. And that's his opinion. I don't have a problem with him having his own opinion. I don't think it's good to, it alarms me, obviously, to think that the view about morality with regard to software is marginalized, because I believe in morality, because I'm a conscientious ethicist.
I think the problem with the morality of free software and proprietary software is, it's really interesting, but it's wrapped up in the fact that it's an issue that you really have to understand fully. It's something that needs to be framed and explained to people before they understand it. It's not intuitive to most people. Mm-hmm. And that's a major problem. So if you were to, I've explained to my parents over and over again, especially my mother, why I think proprietary software is wrong and avoid it wherever I can. But it's taken, 4 or 5 years for her to understand what that means and what user rights are and why it matters. So because it's not like, preventing people from starving or polluting the environment, things that you can see right away, and understand right away. That's sort of a major problem with it, because it needs to be explained. And so people feel like it's a marginal issue because you have to dig into it to understand it.
Well, and also those two things you mentioned are obviously more evil. People starving is more evil. Murder is more evil than proprietary software. It's obvious. But it doesn't mean that something's
like
not evil.
The way I've explained it to my mother sometimes is like, she now tries studiously to avoid getting plastic bags, right?
Yeah, plastic bags are evil.
Right. And, so I say when I avoid proprietary software, it's like I also try to avoid plastic bags. But, you do what you can.
That's the level of evilness it is. That's why I compare it to the recycling thing, because uh-huh. Writing and distributing proprietary software is like failing to recycle. No one would think that you're a good person if you walk up to a trash can and have a recycling bin right next to it and just throw the can in the trash can because you don't feel it. Particularly because somebody pays you. I mean, that's the thing, is that you can make more money writing proprietary software than free software. So you choose to write proprietary software because you can get $10 for putting it in the trash bin and only $1 for putting it in the recycling bin.
But I guess that's sort of like, it's tough when people who are educated in the issues don't see it in the same way that we do. But at the same time, people who aren't, you understand why they don't, why they don't see it as an issue of morality.
Yeah, and I'm shaped, I've said publicly many times that I'm shaped completely by my experiences here. I have developed proprietary software. I have supported it. I've done a lot more proprietary software support than development. And supporting proprietary software I felt that I was actually being injured directly by the proprietary software companies. They were making it harder for me to do my job. They were putting me in situations where I had to basically not help people because they wouldn't help me for no good reason other than they wanted to keep their code proprietary because they thought they could make more money that way. And I had that experience over and over and over again. If people go listen to some of my old speeches from my early days at FSF, I used to talk about this. I'm actually thinking about reprising them? Reprise? Is that how you say
it? That's how I say it. Reprise, I don't know if that's right.
Some of that material, I sort of had this idea that I should have a talk called The Making of a Free Software Radical and sort of explain why I'm so radical. Because I didn't just wake up one morning and say proprietary software is evil. I experienced proprietary software, mostly Solaris was probably my
Informix databases. Well, I think this harks back to our very first episode of the Software Freedom Law Show, where we talked about the making of a free software radical.
We did?
I think we did.
I'm sorry. Oh, I don't remember. I forgot. I apologize.
No. I'm not criticizing you for retreading on old ground. I'm just recommending to people if they want to hear about it. Yeah. I think on our first episode has some of that stuff in it.
Oh, that's right, because we like interviewed each other or something
like that. Yeah, we wanted to introduce ourselves.
That's correct. I remember that now. So Okay, so people are going to write in and tell me whether my use of the word evil is evil.
Well, I'm really curious, actually, because I really...
They could tell me using the word evil in this way is evil or morally wrong.
I feel like people who are listening to our podcast have, you know, have considered opinions about this stuff. And if you all have knee-jerk reactions to it, it's really helpful for us to know.
Yeah, I obviously want to use terminology that's going to connect with people without having to water down the message. It's not that I insist that these are the only right terms for it. I think I've explained why I think it's an issue beyond just convenience, beyond just preference, but an issue of right and wrong. And I don't know the best terminology to use to get that across. And obviously the terminology I'm using is not connecting with people, so I'm open-minded about what other terminology to use.
Can I give an example of really bad terminology that happened recently that I saw? It's a little off topic, but I was reading an article that just was recently published about proposed security options for medical devices, and they interviewed pacemaker patients and basically said, how do you feel about having a password on a bracelet or having, you know, basically because these pacemakers have medium range wireless, you know, you need to make their, you know, security issues are being explored by others who are not interested in free and open source software because they're worried about just the basic security now that they've been shown to be cracked. So it's, you know, it's really, really funny, but they had this, this group published this article, and aside from the article having various issues, like they only interviewed 13 pacemaker patients in the end were part of the study.
That's not even statistically
bad. No, and of those, only 11 were results they could use. I think I know 11 people with pacemakers now. So it's a little strange that it's such a small set. But the security proposals that they included were a bracelet with a password. Another thing that they suggested was having sort of a barcode password on a tattoo on a person's body. And so they proposed one tattoo where it was just a regular ink tattoo and another tattoo that was UV and it UV ink. And it actually caused a lot of discussion online about this technology, and people were kind of excited and also whatever. I didn't see any discussion about the sort of reminiscent of Holocaust use of tattooing, of when you tattoo a particular class of people. Maybe I'm a little more sensitive because I am both Jewish and I have a heart device, so I'm part of and so I was reminded of Holocaust imagery, and I found that disturbing. But I was sort of like, well, I'm overreacting. But then I got to the end of the article, and one of the last sections of the article is actually entitled "The Final Solution Portfolio." And it's like, you know, I wonder who read this article and whether they were attuned to this issue, because that section was just about which of the solutions people were happier with. It had nothing, I mean, they weren't referring to the discomfort that people might have with tattoos, because of this historical use of tattoos for coding, identities on people. So it was really, really interesting to me that they just, I think they inadvertently used that term, and I saw it and I just couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. So when I just completely shut down to that article when I finished reading that. When I got to that point, I'm like, these people don't know who I am, where I'm coming from, what I think is an appropriate solution and what isn't. And that's what happens when you use words that, that are charged for people and you don't realize it. So that's why it's so important.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I agree with you about that, but I don't necessarily see evil as like that. But people are going to write in and tell us, and
yeah,
we'll know. But I thought you were actually going to say that they were suggesting an RFID tag password, which would be kind of funny, because to avoid the wireless, they would give you RFID, which would just be wirelessly readable. Even a password still, it's still...
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. There's a whole host of problematic solutions that they proposed. It's like... It's as if nobody has tackled these questions before. It's really weird to me.
And I'd be more worried about the wireless protocol than password.
Cause, absolutely.
Because if it has to connect somehow first before you can give it a password, in which case, couldn't that protocol be reverse engineered and so forth? I mean, they're sort of reinventing the problems we've had with 802.11.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Mean, we're at the point now where 802.11 is better than, certainly much better than it originally was, but a lot of the early password solutions to 802.11 never worked, mm-hmm. because just simple the protocol analysis would get you the password. And I guess it's less likely to happen in the heart device situation because I actually don't know how often the thing's broadcasting. I guess it's always broadcasting.
It's always broadcasting. I don't have one of those. service. But
I know, so you could pick up the packets then, and over time you might be able to figure out what it's waiting for. If it's a plain text, particularly if it's a plain text password. So I don't see how this gets the most security.
I didn't find any of the solutions to be particularly satisfying.
It's all security through obscurity.
It's very strange.
Oh, speaking of security through obscurity, it could be the case that Google was relying on it for that authentication thing. That's what seems to be being indicated by this stuff. So that's another reason Google should just make all their whole system free software. They may not have known they were relying on security through obscurity.
Yeah, I haven't. I mean, I read about it, but I didn't read about the details. So.
Well, nobody knows. It's just some source code that was proprietary was taken from Google.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, people's Gmail accounts started. Large amounts of Gmail accounts were broken into. So there's only correlative evidence, as far as I can tell, because the two events happened close in Walcock time proximity. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's an indication that maybe security through obscurity was being relied on. So, it's another. People think security through obscurity works. They still do after all this time. It's so horrible.
It is. It's unbelievable. People in the security. It's completely unbelievable.
Well, people in the computer security world are as frustrated with this as free software people are about their issues, because it's the same sort of thing. They've been, because I used to be in computer security early in my career, and everybody talked about how security through obscurity didn't work. I believe security through obscurity can slow people down, which it does. So I often implement security through obscurity as an additional measure on top just to slow people down. But it's known to not work. So, yeah, people still rely on it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Heart device makers are relying on it.
It's amazing and frustrating. All right, well, we have a couple more things to talk about, but maybe we should take a quick break.
So you're a movie star now? Is that the story?
No, I'm not a movie star, but somebody...
Well, you're a star of a movie.
Well, I'm not a star either of that movie. I'm in a movie. It's a short movie. It's a documentary.
So you're a star.
I'm certainly not a star. But somebody messaged me and said after the last Ogcast had said something like... I saw a movie last night, and I thought for sure he was referring to Hot Tub Time Machine.
Don't bring that movie up again.
It was good.
I don't believe it.
But in fact, he was referring to this software patents movie that some of us from SFLC were interviewed for.
I wasn't a movie star like you.
You're not, you know, I think only, no, I don't know. Is it all lawyers? I didn't remember if it was all lawyers. Well, no, it's not all lawyers because Richard Stallman is interviewed.
That's true. But the people from here are all lawyers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it has a few of us from SFLC. It's called Patent Absurdity, How Software Patents Broke the System. And it's available on patentabsurdity.com. And it was put together with a grant from the FSF. And I'm glad to be part of it, actually. It was produced all with
free software, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And they actually say, if you go to the About section on their website, they'll say what they used to make it, which I think is really cool.
And apparently you're promoting Ubuntu.
Oh, yeah. So I've been running Ubuntu, and I actually didn't realize I was going to be interviewed. And I was interviewed at my desk, and I hadn't thought about it. And my screen is in the background, and so I've got the Hardy Heron behind me. But at least people can see that while I am advertising, at least I'm running a free distribution, and people can see that. So
you're not running a free distribution; you're running Ubuntu.
Well, come on. Let's not talk about what's evil all over again. This is already a long Ogcast. But you know, I'm happy for people to see what I'm running, so that's fine. It's just funny that it's so prominent in the background for me.
Even when I was running Ubuntu, I still had this background, so they would have seen that.
Right.
Which is
Mystery Science Theater.
That's what it is, yes, but it's a...
Because I see the I see the silhouettes.
Yeah, it's just the silhouettes against the blue background.
But if I hadn't known that already, I wouldn't have noticed, probably, because it's the...
Well, that's because the
difference between the navy blue and the...
When it's darker, black. It's more obvious.
Oh, okay.
It's just because of the light shining in from the window right now.
I gotcha.
But, Mystery Science Theater. You know, I'm watching them all.
Are you?
I went back to the beginning, yeah.
Huh? So you don't want me to talk about Hot Tub Time Machine, but...
Yeah, well, we can talk about Mystery Science Theater, because that's actually of interest.
You haven't even seen Hot Tub Time Machine.
I know. Why are we talking about this again?
It was really funny. Okay. So, anyway, Patent Absurdity is... I think it's really interesting. It's short, and it sets out a lot of the issues that are coming up around Bilski. So if you're sort of thinking about, you know, how to prepare yourself for understanding the decision when it comes down, it's not a bad place to start.
Maybe we should do a missed audio track of Patent Absurdity.
A missed audio track?
A missed MST2K. You can miss it. Yeah.
Since I'm in the movie, I don't think I would like that very much.
That's true.
It's usually pretty brutal.
No, not totally. Well, maybe.
It's pretty brutal.
I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, I was glad to be able to participate in it.
Okay.
And there's that. The other thing that we wanted to talk about was...
yeah, you have some warning to issue for all nonprofits. Well, red alert.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really I think most of the organizations that we know of are on top of this, but the IRS rules have changed, and they changed some time ago, but the negative implications are going to happen soon.
So, May 15th, right?
Yeah. So basically, the IRS changed its rules for reporting on 990s. It used to be that if your organization took in less than $25,000, you didn't need to file a Form 990 of any kind. But now the requirement is that you file, they call it an e-postcard. It's a 990N. And it's really kind of strange because you can go on the IRS website and click to the form, and it will send you to an e-postcards website, which is not maintained by the IRS, but files with the IRS. It's a little weird, but it's very easy to do. I just did one today for one of the nonprofits that we help, and it took me all of, you know, 2 minutes to fill it out when you're making less than $25,000 a year. You look like you have a question.
Oh, it's just troubling to me that they're using a third party.
Yeah, it is a little troubling. But the point is that it's easy to do. A lot of small nonprofits don't know that the rules have changed.
Because they might have been for years never following a 990 because yes. They've always been less than 25, particularly yes. Small organizations where it's
exactly,
only a few people.
Exactly. And if you're not filing if you don't file your Form 990s, you could lose your tax exempt status. And so, you know, even if your organization does very little, you probably want to maintain it as a functional organization.
And people, while we're mentioning this, people should check out their state and commonwealth level filings. Yep. I know a lot of nonprofits have not paid attention yep. to that. And some states and commonwealths don't check up that often either. Yep. So it's very easy to fall out of compliance on that for a long period of time. So while you're checking this, and a lot of those have no requirements for amount of money. Yeah. You just have to file
some
something
states,
every year.
Like Delaware, if you choose to incorporate in Delaware, you probably have an agent for service of process, and those agents send reminders for the filings. So some
that's
states
because like Delaware is evil with regard to the way it lets anybody
evil
file
again.
A corporation.
But,
actually, I used that on purpose. But
so
Delaware
it's important to stay up to date on the state filings. And, you know, there's some, if you look at the announcement on the IRS website, and there was an article in the New York Times as well, you know, they say that they're, you know, they want to work with nonprofits. They don't want to catch small nonprofits out, and they understand that there might be a disproportionate effect on them. So, you know, often you can, you know, don't, if you are involved in an organization that hasn't done its filings, you know, don't start by freaking out. Just, you know, look into filing the right forms, get up to date, cure the problem before there's any corrective action taken by the agencies, and you'll probably be okay.
And if you're a free software nonprofit, you can write to help at softwarefreedom.org, and Karen will help you because it's
most
an easy
likely
task. Yeah, we probably yeah. would help them.
Oh, for the e-postcard filing? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so but only for free software nonprofits are we available. But there's probably other services out there for yeah. other nonprofits.
But it's worth asking the organizations that you care about that you're not certain that they're filing their 990s, just to be on the safe side. I think that's it.
Okay.
Okay.
So.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, wow. We're just ending right there.
Okay. I mean, I don't.
Okay. That's fine.
You can... write to us.
Well, they're supposed to write to us about evil.
About evil. But if you have any questions about anything else, about nonprofit stuff or otherwise, write to oddcast@softwarefreedom.org.
Yep.
You can donate to us at softwarefreedom.org/donate. And anything to add, Bradley?
I guess not.
Talk to you next time. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
I keep my feathers numbered for just such an emergency.